If you buy a standard pack of premium cigarettes, you are holding roughly 300 milligrams of highly addictive nicotine right in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, which is a massive amount.
Right. But if you were to actually smoke that entire pack, your body would only ever see about 20 milligrams of it.
Which just sounds wrong. I know.
It really does. So where does the rest go? I mean, it literally just vanishes into thin air.
It completely defies how we normally think about consuming a substance because we are deeply conditioned to expect precision, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like you take a 200 milligram painkiller, your bloodstream receives 200 milligrams. Or you measure a teaspoon of baking soda for a recipe, you get exactly one teaspoon. The inputs and the outputs are, well, they're supposed to match.
But the moment you step into the world of nicotine consumption, that measuring spoon basically shatters.
It really does.
The dosage landscape is murky, it's chaotic, and the numbers printed on the side of a box rarely match the reality of what's happening inside the human bloodstream. So, welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Our mission today is exploring a massive stack of scientific studies, clinical pharmacokinetic papers, and regulatory analyses. And they're all focused on one incredibly misunderstood topic, which is how nicotine actually gets into your body. We are putting traditional combustible cigarettes side by side with modern electronic vaping systems.
And we are really looking past the sensational headlines here. We're going to break down the raw chemistry of these products, the thermodynamics of inhalation, and the fascinating behavioral psychology behind how people actually use them in the real world.
Because why does this matter to you? Well, whether you use these products yourself or you know someone who does, or if you simply want to understand the massive public health and regulatory debates happening globally right now, you need to understand one foundational rule.
Right, which is that the user, not the product, determines the dose.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with that massive mathematical illusion I mentioned at the top. The sheer difference between what is inside a cigarette versus what actually makes it into a person.
Yeah, the gap is just staggering. An average unlit tobacco rod, so just your standard cigarette acts as a chemical reservoir. It contains somewhere between 10 to 14 milligrams of nicotine.
Okay, and I think I read that some have even more.
Yeah, in some high-yield premium brands, that chemical payload can climb all the way up to like 28 milligrams per rod.
But you're saying almost none of that actually hits the bloodstream.
Right, only a tiny fraction survives the journey. The systemic yield, meaning the amount that actually enters the blood and reaches the brain, is only 1 to 1.5 milligrams per cigarette session.
Wow.
Yeah, over 90% of the nicotine in that tobacco rod is just completely lost during the act of smoking.
So it's like buying a massive, expensive gourmet pizza, but dropping 90% of it on the floor before you can even take a single bite.
That's a great way to put it.
It just seems wildly inefficient. Where does all that lost nicotine actually go?
Well, it comes down to the brutal mechanism of delivery. Smoking a cigarette is fundamentally a process of thermal distillation.
Meaning fire.
Exactly. The tobacco at the tip of the cigarette is burning at extreme temperatures, often as high as 900 degrees Celsius.
That is incredibly hot.
It is. So as that cherry burns down the rod, the nicotine is vaporized just ahead of the combustion zone. It condenses onto microscopic droplets of tar, and those tar droplets act as the vehicle carrying it into the lungs.
Oh, I see.
But because that heat is so extreme, most of the nicotine is simply destroyed by the fire.
It literally just burns away.
Right. And the rest is either trapped in the physical filter at the back, or it dissipates into the surrounding air as side stream smoke, while the cigarette is just, you know, sitting there between puffs.
Wait, if dropping 90% of the pizza on the floor is so wildly inefficient, why are combustible cigarettes so notoriously addictive?
Yeah.
I mean, if the body's only getting a tiny fraction of the drug, the math still feels a bit off. Something else must be amplifying that 1 milligram.
What's fascinating here is the chemistry of the additives and the combustion byproducts. We can't just look at the raw milligrams of nicotine in a vacuum.
Okay, so what else is in there?
Well, tobacco naturally contains sugars, and manufacturers historically add even more sugars to the casing. When you burn those sugars at 900 degrees Celsius, they undergo thermal degradation and produce breakdown products called aldehydes.
Aldehydes.
Yeah, and one of the most prominent is a chemical called acetaldehyde.
So the extreme heat creates acetaldehyde. I usually associate aldehydes with things like chemical preservatives or, I don't know, alcohol hangovers. What is a chemical like that doing inside a smoker's brain?
It acts as an inhibitor for a specific enzyme in your brain called monoamine oxidase, or MAO.
Okay, let's break that down for everyone. What does an MAO inhibitor actually do?
Think of monoamine oxidase as the brain's natural cleanup crew. Its job is to break down neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin after they've done their job, keeping the brain's chemical levels balanced.
Right.
By inhibiting that enzyme, the acetaldehyde effectively fires the cleanup crew.
Oh, wow. So the dopamine released by the nicotine just sits there and accumulates. It's like locking the doors so the janitors can't sweep away the reward chemicals.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The acetaldehyde reinforces and amplifies the addictiveness of the nicotine. It creates this powerful synergistic effect.
That's wild.
Yeah. And then on top of the aldehydes, there is the crucial role of pH, which is heavily manipulated using ammonia compounds.
Right. I've always heard rumors about tobacco companies adding ammonia. It sounds like something you'd use to clean a kitchen floor, not inhale.
Mm-hmm.
What is the actual chemical purpose of it?
It's a very specific tool for altering the molecular state of the nicotine. Normal cigarette smoke from flue-cured tobacco is naturally a bit acidic. It has a pH sitting around 5.5 to 6.0.
Okay.
In that acidic environment, the nicotine molecule is what chemists call protonated, meaning it carries a positive electrical charge.
And I'm assuming the human body doesn't absorb charged molecules very easily.
It struggles with them, yeah. Charged molecules have a very hard time crossing the biological membranes in your mouth and throat. They require the massive surface area of the deep lung tissue to finally absorb.
Oh, I see.
But when manufacturers introduce ammonia, they artificially increase the pH of the smoke, making it more alkaline. This strips the positive charge away, converting some of that nicotine into an uncharged free base form.
Meaning it can slip right through the tissue immediately before it even gets deep into the lungs.
Exactly. Uncharged molecules cross cell membranes much faster, giving the user that rapid pharmacological hit. And we can actually see this pH manipulation naturally in other tobacco products.
Like what?
Well, look at air-cured tobaccos, like cigars. Cigar smoke is naturally alkaline, often with a pH of 6.5 or higher. Because of that natural alkalinity, a huge portion of the nicotine in cigar smoke is already in that uncharged free base form.
Which explains why cigar smokers don't usually inhale into their lungs. They don't need to.
Yeah.
The lining of the mouth just absorbs it directly because of the pH level.
The oral mucosa takes it right in. So to summarize the traditional cigarette, it's an incredibly wasteful delivery system that destroys most of its own payload, but it compensates for that loss by creating chemical synergies with aldehydes and manipulating the pH to ensure that the tiny amount you do get hits your brain with maximum force.
Okay, so if burning tobacco is basically a giant, inefficient chemical fire, how do modern electronic systems, vapes, get around this?
Yeah.
Because they obviously don't use fire.
Oh, right. They remove the combustion entirely. In a vaping system, the nicotine isn't locked inside a dried plant leaf. It's dissolved in a liquid solvent, which is usually a mixture of propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin.
Okay.
This fundamental change in the delivery vehicle led to a massive evolution in how nicotine is chemically formulated. Specifically, we saw a massive industry shift from free-base nicotine to nicotine salts.
Let's break those two terms down, because anyone looking at these products sees them everywhere. Freebase was the original standard for the early e-liquids, right?
It was, yeah. Early e-liquids used pure alkaline freebase nicotine, and it worked quite well at very low concentrations, like 3 or 6 milligrams per milliliter.
But there was a catch.
A big one. Freebase nicotine has a naturally high pH sitting around 8.0. If a manufacturer tried to increase the concentration to, say, 18 or 24 milligrams to satisfy a heavy pack-a-day smoker, that high pH created a severely harsh, painful irritation in the back of the throat.
So the physical harshness of the chemical itself acted as a natural sealing. A heavy smoker trying to switch would be coughing too hard to actually inhale enough vapor to get the dose their brain was demanding.
Exactly. It was practically unvapable for many people at high strengths. The system was completely self-limiting. Early e-cigarettes simply couldn't deliver nicotine fast enough or smoothly enough to compete with the rapid delivery of a combustible cigarette.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the industry didn't just accept that natural ceiling. They found a chemical workaround.
They did.
The JUL Revolution. They looked at that harshness and essentially engineered it out of existence.
By looking backward at the chemistry of the combustible cigarette, ironically enough.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The developers realized that if they wanted to increase the nicotine concentration without increasing the pain, they needed to lower the pH of the e-liquid. They achieve this by adding organic acids to the mixture, things like benzoic acid, levulinic acid, or salicylic acid.
Okay.
By adding these acids to the alkaline freebase nicotine, they successfully dropped the pH of the liquid from 8.0 down to around 5.5.
Wait, 5.5?
Yeah.
Which is the exact same acidic pH as traditional combustible cigarette smoke that we just talked about.
It is a striking parallel. This chemical process of adding the acid created what we call nicotine salts. By protonating the nicotine molecule, they reduced its volatility in the vapor phase.
And that fixed the throat hit.
It completely smoothed out the harsh throat hit. Suddenly, users could comfortably inhale massive concentrations of nicotine like 50 to 60 milligrams per milliliter without any of the burning or coughing associated with the old freebase liquids.
They completely closed the satisfaction gap between smoking and vaping.
The pharmacokinetic data shows the result clearly. High-strength nicotine salts allowed these very small, low-powered pod devices to deliver an arterial bolus.
A bolus.
Yeah, that's a medical term for a sudden, rapid spike in blood nicotine concentration. The data shows users hitting 10 to 30 nanograms per milliliter in their blood plasma in just 2 to 5 minutes.
For someone who doesn't read blood plasma charts all day, what does 10 to 30 nanograms actually feel like to the user?
It feels like that immediate, intense morning head rush. It is the exact delivery speed and pharmacological reward that a smoker experiences from their first cigarette of the day. The craving is satisfied almost instantly.
Okay, so the chemistry problem is solved. The liquid is mathematically optimized to hit hard and fast. But wait, if these organic acids made it so incredibly smooth that you can comfortably inhale 50 milligrams of nicotine, well, why aren't people passing out from nicotine poisoning left and right?
The good question.
The math isn't adding up. There has to be another variable controlling the dose here.
The missing variable is the hardware. This is a crucial distinction between smoking and vaping. With a traditional cigarette, the hardware is completely standardized.
It's a paper tube and a cellulose filter. The user just lights it.
Right. But in vaping, the hardware itself is a primary determinant of your final dose. Two people could be vaping the exact same 6 milligram liquid from the exact same bottle. But if they are using different devices, their blood nicotine levels will look completely different. It all comes down to Ohm's law.
Oh boy, physics class. Let's keep this out of the textbook. Can we use an analogy here? Is electrical resistance sort of like water flowing through a garden hose?
That is a brilliant way to visualize it, actually. The interplay between the device's battery voltage, the electrical resistance of its heating coil, which is measured in ohms, and the airflow determines the nicotine flux.
Nicotine flux.
Yeah, that's the mass of nicotine emitted in the vapor per second. Let's use your hose analogy. First, you have sub-ohm devices. These use heating coils with an electrical resistance of less than 1.0 ohm. Low resistance is like having a massive, wide-open fire hose. It allows a huge amount of electrical current to flow from the battery, generating high power, often 40 to 100 watts or more.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is. This high heat vaporizes a massive volume of liquid in a split second, producing those giant, dense clouds you sometimes see people exhaling.
So if you're pulling from a fire hose, you're inhaling a massive physical volume of vapor. I'd imagine you have to pair those sub-ohm devices with very low nicotine liquids, like 3 or 6 milligrams. Because if you put a 50 milligram salt in a fire hose, you'd make yourself violently ill.
You would experience severe nicotine toxicity almost immediately. So the hardware dictates the liquid choice. Now look at the other style, mouth-to-lung or MTL vaping.
Okay, what's that?
These devices use coils with a resistance of 1.0 ohm or higher. This is your narrow, restrictive garden hose. They operate at very low power, maybe 10 to 20 watts, and have a tight airflow that forces you to draw on it exactly like a cigarette.
Which produces very little visible vapor.
Right. Very little vapor volume, which makes that narrow garden hose the perfect, safe vehicle for delivering those high-strength 50 milligram nicotine salts we discussed earlier.
You know, I want to bring up a specific clinical study from our sources by Heiler and colleagues, because it proves exactly how wild this hardware equation gets in the real world.
Yeah, that study is fascinating.
So if I have two bottles of liquid sitting on a table, a 3 milligram bottle and an 8 milligram bottle, common sense says the 8 milligram bottle is going to give me more nicotine. It's a higher number.
The logical assumption is that higher concentration equals higher dose.
But the Heiler study proved that is totally wrong. They put the low nicotine liquid, the 3 milligram, into a high power sub-ohm device running at 40.5 watts.
The fire hose.
Exactly. Then they put the high-nicotine 8 milligram liquid into a low-power device running at just 13.5 watts. The users vaping the 3-milligram liquid actually absorbed significantly more nicotine into their bloodstream than the users vaping the 8-milligram liquid.
It perfectly illustrates why looking at the concentration on the bottle is dangerously misleading. In that study, the high-power device vaporized 0.23 milliliters of physical liquid in just 10 puffs. The low-power device only vaporized 0.07 milliliters.
That's a huge difference in volume.
It is. It's not just about the raw milligrams dissolved in the bottle. It's about the sheer physical volume of liquid that gets aerosolized by the heat and pulled into the lungs.
So the hardware is basically acting as an amplifier for the liquid. Turn up the wattage, you turn up the dose, regardless of what the label says. And the study noted that the users actually rated the 3-milligram high-power setup as the most pleasant and satisfying, which means the sensory experience plays a huge role here too.
The sensory experience is heavily dictated by the additives in the liquid. The solvent itself is a variable.
How so?
Well, propylene glycol, or PG, is the thinner liquid that carries the physical throat hit that traditional smokers often crave. Vegetable glycerin, or VG, is thicker and is responsible for creating those dense, visible clouds.
And what about flavorings? Menthol is obviously a massive topic of discussion in both traditional cigarettes and vapes. Does it actually change the dose, or is it just a taste preference?
Menthol is highly significant from a physiological standpoint. It isn't just a flavor, it's an active chemical agent. Menthol activates specific cooling receptors in the human body called TRPM8 receptors.
Is it that similar to using a menthol cough drop when you're sick? Like you suck on the lozenge to numb your throat so you can breathe deeply in the cold winter air without breaking into a coughing fit?
It is the exact same biological mechanism. By activating those cooling receptors, menthol actually suppresses the human cough reflex.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when menthol is present in the vapor or the smoke, a user can take significantly deeper, longer puffs without their lungs rejecting the irritant.
Which means more nicotine.
Right. Deeper puffs naturally increase the surface area exposure in the lungs, which increases their overall nicotine intake.
Okay, we need to pause and look at the sheer number of variables we've uncovered here. The hardware amplifies the dose.
Yeah.
Menthol numbs the lungs so you can take massive hits. The organic acids eliminate the harshness. If all of these things are secretly manipulating how much drug enters the blood, well, who is doing the math? How are people not constantly overdosing every time they pick up new device?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the behavioral psychology of the user. Because the human brain is doing the math.
The brain.
Yeah. We are talking about the well-documented phenomena of compensatory behavior and self-titration.
Self-titration, meaning the user subconsciously adjusts their own dose on the fly.
Yes. Experienced nicotine users develop a subconscious blood nicotine set point. Their brain demands a very specific chemical level to stave off withdrawal and feel satisfied. To hit that precise set point, the user will subconsciously adjust their puff topography. They will change the depth of their inhale, they will change the duration of the puff, and they will change how frequently they reach for the device throughout the hour.
You know, there was a fascinating study by Benowitz in our sources that looked exactly at this.
Oh, yes.
They wanted to see what happens when you force people into a rigid standardized laboratory test versus an ad libitum test, which is basically a fancy way of saying free use, just letting people use the products naturally the way they would hanging out in their living room.
The contrasting results were incredibly revealing. In the rigid, standardized session where researchers forced the subjects to take exactly 10 puffs over exactly 5 minutes, the combustible cigarette outperformed the vape by a massive margin.
Wow.
It delivered far more nicotine to the blood.
Because a cigarette is burning constantly. You take 10 drags off a 900-degree fire, you get a massive spike of nicotine fast.
Right.
But the vapors in that rigid test fell behind.
Right.
However, when the researchers moved to the free use session, putting the users in a relaxed environment for 4 hours and just letting them use the products whenever they wanted, well, the vapors completely caught up.
They naturally compensated for the lower per puff delivery of the electronic device. The vapors took much deeper puffs, holding the device to their mouth for up to 3.5 seconds per drag, and they puffed more frequently.
And by the end of the day, the total systemic nicotine absorption between the traditional smokers and the vapors was virtually identical.
Exactly identical.
A pack-a-day smoker and a heavy vapor both absorbed roughly 20 to 40 milligrams of actual nicotine into their blood. The brain knows exactly what it wants, and it manipulates the body's breathing patterns to ensure it gets that 20 to 40 milligrams, regardless of the delivery device.
Which totally flips the script on how regulatory bodies approach these products. We can look at this purely objectively by comparing two different regulatory environments and the unintended consequences that followed.
Okay, let's hear it.
In the European Union, the Tobacco Products Directive established a strict legal cap, limiting the nicotine concentration of e-liquids to a maximum of 20 milligrams per milliliter.
But the U.S. market, historically, had no federal cap, which allowed manufacturers to sell pod concentrations up to 59 milligrams per milliliter. So if the EU capped the strength, did those users just consume less nicotine overall?
No, because the law of self-titration always wins. Researchers looked at smokers who switched to vaping in both regions.
And what did they find?
The users in the UK who were legally restricted to the 20 milligram pods ended up consuming double the physical volume of e-liquid compared to the US users who had access to the 59 milligram pods.
Double the volume.
Yeah, they just puffed twice as often and twice as hard to reach that same blood nicotine set point their brain demanded.
They just drained two pods instead of one to get the exact same amount of nicotine in their blood? But what is the consequence of vaporizing double the liquid?
The consequence is a doubling of the toxicological exposure. While the nicotine exposure between the UK and US users was identical, the EU users had to aerosolize twice the volume of liquid solvents, the PG and VG.
And heating those solvents isn't harmless.
Far from it. While vaping successfully avoids the combustion of tobacco, it still relies on a heated metal coil.
Right.
When you heat PG and VG, especially at higher volumes and higher wattages, those solvents undergo thermal degradation. They break down into potentially toxic carbonyl compounds like formaldehyde and acrolein.
So a regulation specifically designed to lower the user's nicotine strength inadvertently doubled the user's exposure to toxic aerosol degradation products.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking for a straight answer on how a dose of nicotine is measured. But what we found is that delivery is practically a living, breathing equation.
It really is.
It's never just a number printed on a cardboard box. Mm. It's this incredibly complex dance of thermodynamics at 900 degrees, the pH levels of the smoke or vapor, the electrical resistance of the hardware, and the subconscious automatic breathing patterns of the human body.
That's spot on.
Whether a person is inhaling the 4,000 plus chemicals from burning a tobacco leaf or aerosolizing solvents in a modern sub-ohm vape, the user almost always finds a way to get the exact dose their brain is demanding.
That is the ultimate takeaway here, and it is vital context for anyone analyzing this space. Electronic systems do operate at much lower temperatures, and they do successfully eliminate the 70-plus known carcinogens created by burning tobacco leaves.
But they are not entirely risk-free.
No, they're not. The thermal degradation of those solvents into formaldehyde, plus the documented risk of heavy metals like nickel and lead leaching from the heating coils into the liquid over time, well, it means vaping is fundamentally a shift in the delivery vehicle.
Right.
You are trading the severe known toxins of a combustion fire for a lesser but still very present profile of aerosol risks.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final fascinating mystery we uncovered in the sources. A little something to ponder. We've talked extensively about how the device, liquid, and the breathing patterns affect the dose. But what about the liver?
This brings us to the profound role of human genetics. Specifically, the CYP2A6 gene.
This gene dictates the production of the enzyme responsible for metabolizing nicotine into a byproduct called cotinine in the liver. And the sources show there is massive genetic and ethnic variability here.
Huge variability, yeah.
Some people naturally possess low activity alleles for this gene. They're what the literature calls slow metabolizers. Nicotine literally stays in their bloodstream longer before the liver clears it out.
Which changes their entire behavioral profile. A slow metabolizer naturally needs significantly less nicotine to feel satisfied because their body isn't aggressively removing the drug.
Interesting.
The data shows they tend to smoke fewer cigarettes per day, they take shallower puffs, and they actually have a demonstrably higher success rate when attempting to quit using nicotine replacement therapies.
So if my liver and your liver process the exact same puff of vapor at totally different speeds, and my brain holds on to the drug twice as long as yours, well, is it even scientifically possible to create a one-size-fits-all public health regulation?
It's a great question.
If governments design a rigid legal cap on nicotine strength based on an average user, it might perfectly help one of us but completely fail the other, driving them to compensate and expose themselves to more toxins. It really makes you question how we design these overarching policies.
It's the ultimate challenge for regulatory science right now, when the internal genetic machinery of the user is the final deciding factor in the dose. Standardizing the external product will always yield unpredictable and sometimes counterproductive results.
The body is the ultimate mathematician. We started today talking about the comfort of taking a 200 milligram painkiller and knowing exactly what you're getting. Well, that absolute certainty simply does not exist here.
Not at all.
That measuring spoon is broken. The dosage is decided by 100 tiny variables, starting with the electrical resistance of a metal coil and ending with the unique genetic code inside your own liver. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this gave you some real clarity and a new perspective on a topic that is usually drowned in political noise and sensationalism. Stay curious, look past the labels, and keep questioning the science behind the headlines. We'll catch you on the next one.